The U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear a potentially landmark case on the Second Amendment. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Friday, April 30th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we bring you multiple perspectives on our April South Dakota Public Broadcasting Spotlight, Guns in South Dakota. We'll talk about the history of the Second Amendment and new challenges that might change the debate for decades. We hear your stories about guns in your life, and we recap our spotlight coverage. We also look at efficiencies in higher education. Board of Regents Executive Director Brian Maher joins us with an update. We look at vaccination efforts in the Flanders Santee Sioux Tribe. We talk rural vets and graduating seniors. Plus, Eliza Blue examines the distance between the things we want and the things we need. It's all coming up this hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary. Governor Kristi Noem plans to sue the National Park Service for refusing a fireworks show this summer at Mount Rushmore National Memorial. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
Governor Noem made her announcement at a speech before the Watertown Rotary Club on Thursday.
I'm going to file a lawsuit against the administration to get the fireworks back.
The governor says the document allowing last year's fireworks event included a multi-year agreement.
Because I have contracts, I have done all the permits, I've done all the work. We've gone through all of this, and there's no reason to pull them from me except for it being political, and so we're going to challenge that.
The 2019 agreement, signed under the Trump administration, said the Department of Interior and the state agree to pursue working to return fireworks to Mount Rushmore National Memorial in a safe and responsible manner beginning in 2020. The state held the first fireworks show in a decade last July with former President Donald Trump in the audience. The Park Service says it will not allow fireworks this year because of the coronavirus, concerns over wildfire hazard, the potential for water contamination, and tribal opposition. Earlier this month, Governor Noem wrote President Joe Biden a letter urging him to reinstate the fireworks show. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The only movie theater on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation will open today for the first time in over a year. The Noonpa Theater closed its doors last March, only opening its concession stand a few times a week to sell food and drinks. Angel Reddist is the owner and manager. She says this past year was tough, but the community is excited for the reopening.
They've been asking me, when are you going to open? When are you going to open? For a long time, but we didn't feel safe to open until the vaccines came out, but now we feel a little more secure and we're ready to go.
The theater is in Kyle. Reddist also owns a convenience store in Kyle, which she did not close last year. She's grateful she had another source of income.
Otherwise, we would be in dire straits. If we didn't have that, we would be very, very hurt.
The Oglala Sioux Tribe took extraordinary steps to protect tribal members from COVID-19. Tribal officers erected checkpoints to restrict non-residents from entering tribal lands. Governor Kristi Noem opposed the checkpoints. Noem also refused to order statewide business closures or mask mandates. About that, Reddis says,
I'm still angry. For a while, it was pretty nice because most of the stores in Rapid City were requiring masks, but then it's getting more lenient as the weeks go on, and it's like people don't even care anymore.
But for now, Reddis says she's happy to get back to showing movies and interacting with the community. Noonpa Theater will require masks and sell only 35% of its seats to encourage social distancing. The South Dakota Department of Labor and Regulation says new unemployment claims are falling. Unemployed workers filed 215 claims last week. That's 120 fewer than the week before. There are more than 2,900 South Dakotans currently receiving unemployment assistance. The Department of Labor and Regulation has paid out almost $373 million in state and federal unemployment benefits since the pandemic began. Highs in the mid-80s in the west to the low 70s in the east. It'll be sunny and windy in the west. Temperatures are going to dip into the 50s tonight across the state. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
And I'm Lori Walsh. This month, our SDPB spotlight has been on the issue of guns in South Dakota. Later in this hour, you'll hear several viewpoints from South Dakota scholars, gun owners, activists about everything from the history of the Second Amendment to the rate of suicide by gun in the state. South Dakota is a permitless carry state. The state legislature passed a revision in our self-defense laws this session with legislation commonly called a Stand Your Ground bill. Other states approach the Second Amendment quite differently. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case this fall that could serve as a landmark for generations to come. The law at issue in New York Rifle and Pistol Association v. Corlett says for a resident of the state of New York to receive an unrestricted license to carry a concealed firearm outside the home, that person must show what is known as proper cause. In other words, they must show a need for self-protection. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit upheld that law, and the challengers then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mike Hammond is Chief Legislative Counsel for Gun Owners of America, and he's joining us for one perspective on the importance of this case. Mike Hammond, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Lori. Hello, South Dakota.
Tell me a little bit from your perspective about the significance of the Supreme Court agreeing to hear this particular case.
Well, I think it's probably the most important case in at least a couple of decades. In 2008, the Supreme Court took up the Heller case. And in that case, it decided that the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, is the right of an individual, not just the right of a governor to organize a militia, as the left had argued up until then. However, in order to get Anthony Kennedy's vote among the five justices for that proposition, the person who authored the decision, Antonin Scalia, put in what was called page 54. It's some nebulous language saying that the Second Amendment isn't absolute. And in the intervening 13 years, most of the lower court cases that have taken up the Second Amendment have upheld even very extreme state statutes based on that nebulous language. So now, with probably Amy Coney Barrett constituting the fifth pro-gun judge on the Supreme Court, we believe that we have a pro-gun majority that will actually use the Second Amendment to overturn questionable state statutes rather than just creating a principle which has no application.
So we are seeing some early indications based on certain justices. We've heard, and of course we know, Justice Clarence Thomas has come out and asked specific questions that would indicate his early thoughts on this case. Amy Coney Barrett also clerked for Scalia. So what does that page 54 precedent mean as these justices evaluate this new case?
Well, no one knows exactly what page 54 means. It's meant that the circuit courts could decide anti-gun and use that as a pretext for doing so. I should say that there are very few advantages to being very old, but one of them was that in 1986, I was working for the United States Senate, and I drafted and managed the McClure-Votemer Firearms Owners Protection Act. Now, that means that both Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett have interpreted from the bench language which I wrote, and all three of them interpreted them in ways that I intended. So I'm pretty comfortable that in addition to Thomas, who's actively called for the court to take up Second Amendment issues, that we do have a five-vote majority, maybe even six with Roberts, for a pro-gun position on this case.
They have asked for a more narrow review of the case at hand. What does that tell you?
That tells me that there are several ways you could resolve this case. The first is to implement the South Dakota system. That is to say that no one can be restricted so long as they're legally entitled to possess a firearm. They can't be restricted from carrying a firearm even if they don't get the permission of the government in the form of a permit. That would be the broad interpretation. A more narrow interpretation would say, okay, the state can require a permit, as 30 states do, but that permit either has to be based on objective facts, that is, whether or not the person's a criminal, an illegal alien, a drug user, and states that have that system are called shall-issue states, or alternatively, the court could decide that New York is too restrictive in prohibiting anyone but the rich and famous from having firearms by use of this need requirement, which it almost never finds to be the case.
One last question, and it's often when there is, a gun regulation or some kind of gun control restriction that we worry about the so-called slippery slope and where it might end when it comes to infringement. For people who are wondering if the South Dakota interpretation of the Second Amendment really works if you live in New York City when pretty much everybody could be walking down the street armed then, if that was, where does that end for you? And what about that local control of people deciding what their own city needs for public safety?
Well, there are 20 states now that have, quote, constitutional carry, as South Dakota does. They're among the safest states in the country. Some of them, such as Arizona, have fairly large cities in them. When we were pushing that constitutional carry legislation, that is permitless carry, we were told that Arizona, South Dakota, all these places would become the, quote, Wild West, the OK Corral, as if that were an insult of some sort. We find, by and large, even in states with fairly large cities, that hasn't happened. The fact that the guy sitting next to you might have a gun makes you less likely to shoot up a subway car or shoot up a restaurant than you otherwise would be.
Mike Hammond is Chief Legislative Counsel for Gun Owners of America. That case is New York Rifle and Pistol Association v. Corlett. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments on that. We'll have to wait until the fall and beyond for a decision. Mike Hammond, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We will hear more about the history interpretation of the Second Amendment later this hour as we continue our SDPB spotlight on guns in South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment from listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Jazz is an American music, but it's embraced by people all over the world. Today, more than 190 countries are celebrating the 10th annual International Jazz Day, which culminates in an all-star global concert. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll mark the occasion with recent recordings by musicians and composers from around the world. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin. More than a year into the pandemic, a lot of things are still on pause. Maybe you've added some new rituals for a sense of normalcy, a virtual meetup or an online fitness class. Staying connected is as simple as ever. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Join us weekdays at 5 a.m. Central and weekends at 7 a.m. Central on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. SDPB radio listeners are company presidents, board members, and top executives in businesses around the state. Your company can reach these influential business leaders. Contact SDPB and ask about corporate support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Are South Dakotans getting the best return on investment when it comes to higher education? our students getting the best education, one that not only sets them up for successful careers, but helps them navigate life as critical thinkers and knowledgeable citizens. The 2020 state legislative session saw the passage of Senate Bill 55. It directed the establishment of a task force to evaluate public universities in the state. Formal recommendations from that task force are expected this fall. Brian Maher is executive director of the South Dakota Board of Regents, and he returns to In the Moment now with an update. Welcome back, Brian Maher. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Lori. It's always great to hear you, and thanks for having me on.
So education is so important to many South Dakotans coming at it from different directions, and you heard that through the public input phase of this task force. As you move into the, you know, formalizing recommendations, which we won't know much about until November, what are some of the insights that you have gleaned from that public input period that you'd like to share with us today?
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, and you you really put a synopsis around what this is designed to do from the 2020 legislature, saying this is what we need you to look at. And Senate Bill 55 was formed. From there, a task force has been formed. And what we've done to try to take on this incredibly complicated issue is we've really divided it up into three areas. We've divided it up into academics, infrastructure and ancillary issues, and then administration of our campuses as well. So we're really looking at those three areas, and we've had three meetings we've had already, and I think we're really getting into the meat now, where some of those issues where you can kind of begin to see where this is headed. Where we might formalize some topics to address. I would say, Lori, at this point, what I've probably gleaned from that public input so far is that this isn't going to be an event as much as if this is going to be part of the process. And by that, I mean the return on investment that you referenced really isn't going to be a cut this or add that. Rather, it's going to be how do you look at the strategic plan and develop what you want to do over the next year, 3 years, 5 years, as a result of the conversations that comes from Senate Bill 55.
Yeah, that should, I would think, make some people have a sigh of relief, because, of course, their big fear was cuts and mergers and big slashing activity. And I want to ask you this before we really run short of time. So much of the concern we hear out of state lawmakers has to do with meeting the workforce needs of the future. Are we sending our students to university and putting them into the workforce in a way that makes sense for the state and makes sense for them? But other people are saying, you know, higher ed can be too restrictive and career focused. And I just wanted to ask you, as you think about this broadly, what do you think the role of higher education is?
Well, I think in our simplest form, really, it is to prepare the students of our state, and obviously there are students in our programs that aren't from South Dakota, but to prepare the students in our state for the workforce that we need in our state, and also for their own personal future. So there's a dynamic there that this isn't solely workforce development. There's also a whole lot of personal development that goes into this as well. So, how do we become all things to all people in that regard? Really is, I think, part of what we're trying to figure out.
Do you feel like you're in the right place at the right time to have that come? Because that to me sounds like something you really enjoy spending a lot of time thinking and talking about.
Yeah, for sure. I think on a personal level, my mission is to really help people become the fullest potential of their own version that they can become. So without a doubt, I love that. It's a complicated issue, and you kind of addressed it there. You know, we do have to look at a duplication of programs, and are the programs that we're looking at meaningful? So we're actually looking at some research right now that says, here's what South Dakota needs today. Here's what South Dakota is going to need in the future. And by the way, some of those programs that might be characterized as meaningless, some of those degrees that might be characterized as meaningless, what we're finding out is those people end up in very meaningful jobs. So we've got a lot to dissect yet, but this isn't a black and white topic. It's not a simple on or off switch that we can hit.
Yeah. Brian Maher is Executive Director of the South Dakota Board of Regents, and we'll continue to follow the direction of this task force throughout the summer and into the fall and as long as it takes. Brian, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
More on our South Dakota Spotlight on Guns after a quick break. You're on Listener Supported SDPB.
With COVID-19 cases falling and vaccinations rising, cruise lines say it's time to let them sail.
There's just no excuse to continue to keep the cruise industry tied to the pier.
U.S. health authorities say not without safeguards like onboard COVID test labs.
It's hard to imagine the CDC prioritizing cruise ships right now when we still have some schools that are closed.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
As news cycles spin more furiously, the stories of our everyday lives and local traditions can get lost. SDPB prioritizes South Dakotans' daily realities by building community one story at a time. Your gift to the Sound Vision campaign supports crucial, trustworthy news, and you also help SDPB chronicle how we live and what we care about. So consider a gift. Visit sdpb.org/soundvision.
The exploration of cutting-edge products and services being offered in South Dakota is highlighted on our Science and Technology Beat, supported on SDPB by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Americans' love affair with guns begins at an early age, and often those stories feed into our personal politics as we seek to sort through some of the most challenging issues of modern America: gun rights and gun regulations, gun safety and gun violence. Our April SDPB Spotlight on Guns in South Dakota began with a simple question. What is one of your earliest memories that relates to guns? Today, as we recap multiple viewpoints of that project, we begin with a few of those stories. So first here, you will hear the voice of SDPB's Larry Rohr. Then you'll hear from two listeners who called in with stories of their own. And finally, you'll hear from NRA Certified Firearms Instructor Matt Schluter, all of them sharing one of their earliest memories about guns.
I've been hunting for a long time, first with my father riding along, and then it kind of drifted away from my life and came back with my wife Marilyn, her family, and a long tradition of hunting and caring for land, and made part of it. And then a puppy came into my life. Oh my gosh, you know, and it was a puppy that taught me how to hunt. And I like to hear, when I get a chance to travel around the state and talk to people, what would be your perfect day? You know, if you could design a day in South Dakota, what would be the thing you do? And I want to take, spend time with my kids or whatever out of it and just say, no, this is for you. And I ask that question because mine involves hunting for the state game bird later in the season when the out-of-state people are gone, middle of the week when it's quiet, being out there with the dog, and that's the perfect day. And it involves a gun, but the gun is not the centerpiece.
And my first memory would probably have been my Bat Masterson outfit with the six shooters and the vest and hat and the business card that said, "Have gun, will travel."
My first real memory of guns was when my third grade classmate was shot and killed by his babysitter using my classmate's mother's handgun that she kept in her bedside table. we had guns in our house, but I had never really thought about them. And later when my sister took hunter safety and went out hunting with some friends and my dad, I just never showed an interest. And it hasn't been until I became an adult that I've connected my disinterest in guns and my current dislike of guns to that classmate being shot and killed. And now it makes me, as a parent, concerned about my children spending time in people's homes who have guns, which is almost just an assumption in South Dakota. Thanks.
I was seven.
Seven.
Yeah. Welcome to America. My dad hauled me to the, my dad made me go to the city dump with him to help unload his F-100 pickup. We get done unloading and we're at the city dump. I grew up in a really small town. And he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, look, the city bar dumped all their bottles." And I was like, "Oh." And he goes, "Go pick up those bottles and put them on that tree stump." And by the time I get done, I mean, I'm 7 years old. I really didn't realize what he had planned. He had pulled out a single action Ruger 22 caliber pistol. And he goes, "Well, it's probably time you learn how to shoot."
Wow. And you had no idea that was coming.
No, we didn't use eye protection. We didn't use ear protection. I mean, my dad had his own way of teaching. Probably not to the what everyone would consider, you know, the NRA standard, yeah, for instruction, but, you know, it was all there. Keep your finger off the trigger, keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. This is how it works. Guns are dangerous. And of course he demonstrated that by then sending me out to fill bottles full of water. But anyways, in a road ditch, you know, so you could watch them explode.
Right.
But, you know, to a little kid, these things are important, yeah, but you don't see a lot of that today.
Every story has a beginning. Those early memories of contemporary South Dakotans intersect with the intentions of America's founders. Here is the text of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. We asked longtime congressional staffer Chuck Parkinson to help us unpack the early scholarship on the Second Amendment.
One sentence has caused lots of conversation over the last 200 plus years. In the original days, after independence was gained and the Constitutional Convention set up, there was a great fear that existed about the tyranny which they had led up to this particular point, because in the past what had happened was that monarchs in Europe had used their armies to force the populace to do certain things. And so as things evolved when the Constitutional Convention came together, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, where the Federalists wanted a strong central authority and the Anti-Federalists were very strong about keeping the authority at the states, there isn't much actually written about the Second Amendment debate during the Constitutional Convention in 1787. In fact, James Madison kept really deliberate notes on the convention, and he didn't write a single word about the individual's rights to a firearm. The main focus was on a well-regulated militia, and the discussion that took place really was based a lot upon writings of Alexander Hamilton, who wrote in the Federalist Papers 29 and 49, that the right to bear arms really referred to military activities of a well-regulated militias, and the fear being that if the states had the militias, they would be able to act to protect those particular states.
Centuries have passed since Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay wrote the Federalist Papers defending the new U.S. Constitution. SDPB Seth Tupper joined the program with a little history of the culture and conversation of carrying guns in Dakota Territory.
when I went back and did the research on this a couple of years ago, I found out that basically for 155 years, the carrying of concealed weapons in Dakota Territory and then South Dakota was either banned or allowed only with a permit. So it's not until we just got rid of that permit requirement a couple of years ago. The history of this all goes back to the winter of 1864-65, and that was the year when the territorial legislature passed an outright ban on concealed weapons, meaning you were just forbidden to carry concealed weapons at all. And that was part of a nationwide trend in response to gun violence, where all but a handful of U.S. states had outlawed concealed weapons by about 1900. And there was kind of a widely held opinion among some people that carrying a concealed weapon rather than an open weapon was somehow inherently suspicious. Mm-hmm. And there was plenty of evidence of that in the newspapers of the day. You think about Deadwood, for example, in 1879, guns were the cause of a lot of violence. And that year, the Black Hills Daily Times newspaper editorialized that carrying concealed weapons was a, quote, barbarous and unlawful practice. The Daily Deadwood Pioneer Times, I found another editorial there where that paper said the carrying of concealed weapons is not suited to an enlightened people and promotes neither good order in the community nor courage in the individual. And there's the Black Hills Daily Times, and another editorial came on the strongest, and this was, I love some of this old newspaper writing just for the language, but there's also obviously a message here. Yeah. They said, quote, "Let the strong social condemnation of our people make this practice infamous. Let education quicken the public conscience. Let the pulpit do its duty against this unchristian habit. Let the press fearlessly speak its powerful reprobation, that our officers shall feel justified in suppressing this uncivilized and ferocious custom."
The year 2020 saw increased gun violence in America. 2021 dawned with several high-profile mass shootings in states across the country. In South Dakota, gun deaths can be less obvious. In 2019, for example, 113 gun deaths were reported. 87% of those were suicide by gun. The state has the seventh highest firearm suicide rate in the nation. And here's where we're at legislatively. Open carry and permitless concealed carry are legal for residents old enough to purchase a firearm. That's legislation from 2019. In the 2021 legislative session, lawmakers grappled with a revamping of the state's self-defense laws as they debated House Bill 1212. The bill failed, was smoked out of committee, and eventually passed. Proponents say it shores up Second Amendment protections. It's what is commonly called a stand-your-ground bill. Opponents argued that the new law returns South Dakota to a Wild West mentality where residents can shoot first and ask questions later. So, in a debate that has become politically polarizing, is there room for common ground? Here's political science professor Pam Caravu from Black Hills State University.
I think there is room, and even the Supreme Court would say that there's room. District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008, and then McDonald versus Chicago 2 years later, basically said, recognized that there is an individual right to possess arms. It's no longer associated with a militia right. But those cases both said that this is not an unlimited right. We can regulate unusual firearms. We can prohibit felons and people who are mentally ill from possessing them. We can prohibit possession in sensitive places like schools or government buildings. And essentially, the essence of that, of both of those decisions, is that guns are, it's an individual right, and people can have them in their homes for personal protection. But once we start talking about activity outside of the confines of the home, that can be regulated. And ultimately, what we're seeing actually is an increase in people who are single issue pro gun control voters, and that's their top issue, and that's what they're going to vote when they vote for candidates. That's what they're looking for, and I think ultimately that's the key. We're going to need more political mobilization around pro gun control in order to, you know, change the debate, move the debate from this all-or-nothing conversation.
Just like there are single-issue voters for gun control laws, there are single-issue voters for the protection of gun rights. Matt Schluter is a certified NRA firearms instructor, and he has seen a significant increase in South Dakotans seeking training and certification for enhanced gun permits. He says more and more South Dakotans are exercising their Second Amendment rights thoughtfully and responsibly.
I grew up around guns. I use guns. I hunt with guns. My favorite type of hunting, believe it or not, is black powder hunting for deer with a muzzleloader in our state. They give me a really long season to do it with. And it's more challenging because you only get one shot typically. That being said, I have hunted deer with an AR-15. I like shooting them. They're fun to shoot. They have a place. My wife hunts when we rifle hunt with our rifle tags in South Dakota. We both use an AR-15 based rifle. You know, so I don't think you can classify a tool as being bad. You really have to concentrate on it's the actions by the person using it. If we're to talk about criminal behavior, if a criminal used a rock to kill somebody, we're not going to ban all rocks. And if the criminal went out and got drunk and drove through a crowd of people at an open air event, like a spring or summer concert venue, we're not going to ban all the cars. You know, because obviously these people had issues. To be in the frame of mind to commit a violent act against other people, whether it be with your hands, feet, or a weapon of some type, I don't know how you get there. But, you know, we got to hold those people responsible for how they made that choice and making that choice.
The South Dakota State Legislature has spent years now examining and rethinking how the state responds to mental health crises. Remember those 113 gun deaths in 2019 and how 87% of them were death by suicide? Here is Karen Pettigrew. She's from Rapid City, and she leads a local gathering of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. I asked her how she leads people to think more deeply about saving lives in South Dakota in a time when refusal to find common ground can be our default.
I think we approach it through emphasizing gun safety and a culture of gun safety, being aware of the incredible responsibility that it is to be a gun owner, and then going from there to the need to protect others from easy access to guns when harm will result. That would be children in homes, children who are visiting grandparents, children who have play dates. It involves emphasizing the importance of securing locked and unloaded guns in motor vehicles, because theft of guns is a very common occurrence, and stolen guns are always used in criminal activity. So I think the emphasis that on safety is something that people on the spectrum, from those who choose not to own guns to those who collect and own many, many guns, I think we can agree that this is an awesome responsibility, and there are ways to protect and reduce, you know, the incidence of gun violence by being a responsible gun owner.
Today, we have offered you a recap of our SDPB Spotlight on Guns in South Dakota. You can find full interviews and more coverage on the April Spotlight topic on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. And no, we have not answered all the questions you might have about guns in the state. There are plenty of stones left unturned. But we have offered multiple perspectives. And when you talk about guns, gun violence, and gun rights, we hope those multiple perspectives will help you find a little common ground to move the conversation forward for us all.
The May South Dakota Public Broadcasting Spotlight is on missing and murdered Indigenous women. You can find all our coverage at sdpb.org/spotlight. Now, as South Dakota seniors eagerly anticipate graduation 2021, some took time to reflect and share with SDPB how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted their final year of high school. Today, we hear from Todd County senior and Oglala Lakota member Summer Romero.
Growing up as Lakota, it's taught in our ceremonies throughout our entire lives that you need to make sacrifices for people, for your people, especially in like great times of need like this pandemic. And my sacrifice is staying home to protect my community. The hardest for me to deal with is becoming a senior and this being my last year of high school, because I didn't get my volleyball season or my basketball season or my track season. And I didn't even get a rodeo season. I have been rodeoing my entire life since I was 3, but I wasn't able to compete at all last year. It was really sad. Like, I was really sad because I'm really bad at telling time. So my rodeo schedule is how I tell my time and the time of the year. But at the same time, I've been rodeoing for like 14 years, going on 15. So taking 1 year off was really hard. I've had a lot of friends ask me why I didn't rodeo, and because they were like, it's just rodeo, it's outside. But at the same time, if I got it and brought it back home to my family, I'd be putting my brother in great danger because it would really impact him. He was born with a heart murmur, and so if he did get the virus, we don't know how it would affect him or if it would end up killing him. So we took every possible measure to stay safe. But there's always a bright side to things. It did allow me to work with a lot of my young horses and get them trained. I enjoy like starting them from start to finish. So they work with me and I can work with them and we understand each other. Horses have always been my safe place, my escape from reality. So without them, I probably would have been a lot worse throughout the year.
This week on Science Friday, plastics are everywhere, but as they break down, they get into almost everything we eat and drink. Plus, a visit to the future, how futurists predict and imagine what's to come.
It's not about being utopian or sort of putting your blinders on and just kind of being like, technology will solve everything in some sort of magical way.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB Radio.
When's the last time you had a really satisfying conversation?
A perfectly tuned conversation is a vision of sanity, a reassurance that you're a right sort of person and all's right with the world.
How to communicate better with family, friends, and colleagues. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Sunday evening at 6 Central, 5 Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
If you are responsible for your organization's marketing strategy, I'd like your attention for a moment. When you underwrite with SDPB, you are not purchasing airtime or a sponsorship. Your investment makes it possible for us to continue telling stories that are important to South Dakotans. SDPB listeners are more likely to be in upper management, have a valid passport, and save for their retirement. These are the people you reach when you underwrite with SDPB. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Access to rural health care is important to all South Dakotans, including animals, large and small. Providing in-clinic and on-farm animal care is much more than a vocation for South Dakota's rural veterinarians. It's their calling. SDPB's Laura Rohde has this story.
When registered Simmental producer Clay Duxbury began leasing some pasture land a few years back, a mysterious illness began plaguing his cattle, giving his calves fevers and scours.
It was a virus, actually. None of the antibiotics really treated it.
After trying everything he could think of and losing a few calves, the Miller cattleman reached out to his veterinarian, Eric Nock. Nock observed the cattle herd, collected samples, and ran tests. Turns out Duxbury's soil was infected with a virus, but once Nock diagnosed the culprit, he was able to prescribe a treatment that worked for the calves, as well as preventative measures like adding a feed supplement to his cow's diet 90 days before calving.
We've been doing that for 6 years now, and it has completely changed the scope of our herd health.
Outcomes like this are among the reasons Eric Nock became a veterinarian.
Being able to hopefully make a difference, you know, take a situation, a cow that wasn't able to have a calf, and to help to change the outcome of that situation and to make it better.
One of six veterinarians who make up Prairie View Veterinary Clinic, Nock and the team serve livestock and pet owners living near the rural communities of Redfield, Miller, Highmore, and Wessington Springs. Nock says he enjoys the diversity of his work.
It's not a 9-to-5 deal at all. A lot of times take a shoot and go out to the producer's operation and we'll process however many cattle we need to are in that group. And like I said, whether that's pregnancy testing, semen testing bulls, things vaccinating heifers, vaccinating or processing calves, whatever that involves. But then there's also times we'll be in the clinic working on small animals, surgeries, doing spays and neuters. And then this time of year also has calving calls sprinkled in with that come up. And those obviously aren't planned, and so that adds a little variety.
Because Eric Nock and his wife Roxanne also raise cattle, he understands economics of livestock and works to share information to help improve profits.
Our bottom line is already so tight that there's so many things that they can provide us with on knowledge that gives us a chance to have another live calf, healthy calf, healthy herd.
Helping farmers like her grandpa Grant was a childhood goal that motivated Lainey Crinion Schultz to return home to Madison to practice veterinary medicine. She is also licensed to provide animal chiropractic and acupuncture services.
I want people to be able to not travel very far to get high quality medicine for their animals. And, you know, I was there. I remember when I had my best horse break a leg, and my now current boss, she was 8 months pregnant and trucked through 3 feet of snow to help me with my horse. And I just remember that was a huge impact for me that day, being able to call somebody who was 5 miles away and she was there right away.
Timely access to veterinary medicine can be crucial, explains fourth generation cattle producer Cody Williams.
Well, you know, if you've got calving trouble, I mean, a matter of, you know, 5-10 minutes can be the difference between a, you know, a calf getting out alive or, you know, a cow making it if it's really tough.
A registered polled Hereford producer. Since childhood, Williams has taken the best of his family's herd to shows across the U.S. So he also appreciates access to animal chiropractic care.
You know, we had a heifer that had hurt herself here this winter. And we were really nervous that we were not going to get to show her the rest of the winter. And to have Lainey come out and be able to, you know, to work her over and get things set back where they were, we went from not being able to show her with showing her within a month.
Another time, Williams had a bull begin limping before a sale. Lainey Crinion Schultz diagnosed and treated a pinched nerve.
We didn't actually take him out to sell him like we had planned. We ended up keeping him for another year and just go ahead and using him ourselves. And, you know, without her coming and working on him, he probably would have just went to the sale barn because he was, you know, just limping bad enough and hurt bad enough that he would not have been able to go out and breed cows.
Results like these are why Crinion Schultz got her chiropractic certification.
I knew that that was something I could bring back home, which has always been really important to me, being able to bring something valuable to our clients in our rural community that, I mean, they'd otherwise have to travel just to get.
Crinion Schultz says even though most livestock are much larger than humans, animal chiropractic treatment is similar in the fact that it doesn't take extreme force or strength to bring things back into alignment. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
The
big picture state reports about the percentage of people vaccinated tell only part of the story about COVID-19 vaccinations in individual counties. Efforts by the Flandreau Santee Sioux tribe, for example, have played a big role and don't show up in those local numbers. SDPB's Brenda Wade Schmidt reports.
Moody County is a lesson in collaboration when it comes to the coronavirus vaccine and handling the pandemic during the past year. Avera Flandreau and the Flandreau tribe both play a part in getting residents their shots. They work together in the county's largest community of about 2,500 people, where neighbors of all races see each other at the grocery store and local events. Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe President Tody Reeder says protecting tribal members within the community was one of the first goals. The tribe reached out to people who weren't part of their membership with financial help and offers to deliver groceries if people needed them in order to keep the virus out of places where tribal people could be exposed.
We thought it was very important to assist the rest of the county. We're a community within a community that is a situation that we interactions are constant daily.
The results show that out of the county's 17 COVID deaths so far, no tribal member in the county has died from the virus.
A year ago, a lot of us figured half of us might not be here, you know, this time this year. So that I'm glad it's not as bad as it was. And I think it was great how communities were able to come together and build stronger relationships that will continue to go forward.
The tribe was the first in the community to get a shipment of vaccines in December, a supply that has rolled out seamlessly to reservations, the clinic's CEO, Cynthia Jacobs, says. But the work started as soon as she heard the word pandemic. The tribe's priority was to first vaccinate healthcare workers, Dakota language speakers, and elders to protect its future existence. The Flandreau tribe is relatively small, with about 280 members locally and 800 worldwide, Reeder says.
Yeah, definitely. Our language speakers are very valuable. They just have diminished over time with each passing generation, and the way that natives were forced to not speak the language, that took a big part of our culture away.
At this point, the clinic staff has given more than 1,000 shots and have fully vaccinated more than 600 people, including vaccinations to many who live in the same household as tribal members but aren't Native. The clinic helped vaccinate others in the community, too, including staff at the Flandreau Indian School and, more recently, employees at the Royal River Casino. Those numbers, which aren't included in state data because they are federally provided vaccines, mean Moody County has a higher vaccination rate than the 30% they are given credit for by the South Dakota Department of Health. State numbers show that in addition to the tribal efforts, another 1,800 people have gotten at least one shot, with nearly 1,400 Moody County residents having completed their vaccinations. Scott Hargens, administrator at Avera Flandreau, says working together with the tribe has been a blessing.
Just to have another local entity in town that is assisting and a part of the inoculation process as well, I think is just it's awesome. I mean, it's just awesome, and it's definitely been very helpful in terms of just having somebody else that's out there vaccinating people at the same time has just been, I think, a big win for our small community.
At this point, finding additional people who want the vaccine is becoming more difficult at both the tribal clinic and for Avera. The tribe recently worked with FEMA to do dozens of shots. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Brenda Wade Schmidt in Flandreau.
And you can find and share all our news stories from our website at sdpb.org/news. As we welcome May to South Dakota, we say farewell to April. And here is Eliza Blue's April Postcard from the Prairie.
I met Mason in college. He was athletic, charming, and played bass in the coolest band on campus. I didn't know him well, but I liked him. Everyone did. One night, at a loud, crowded house party, we ended up in a small group talking about music. The Stones were really on to something with that lyric, "You don't always get what you want, but you get what you need," our mutual friend Tracy shouted, trying to keep her drink from sloshing out of her cup as someone squeezed past her. It's really true. Totally, I shouted back, partially because I agreed, but mostly because Tracy was from Brooklyn and was much, much cooler than me. Hmm, said Mason. I don't know, because I feel like I've gotten pretty much everything I've really wanted and almost nothing that I really need. He didn't sound sad or angry, just matter of fact, his gaze calm as he took a long sip from his drink. Whoa, I said, into the long pause that followed his words, and in that moment felt a seismic shift in my understanding of my own life. Was it possible that I also was mostly only getting what I wanted and rarely what I needed? It would explain a lot. This time of year is by far the most intense on a ranch. Lambs and calves are born at all hours and in all kinds of weather, and we need to be close by in case the cows and ewes need help. That means checking on the herd and flock regularly throughout the day and the night. Life narrows down to the confines of our barn and pastures, the hours filled past brimming with chores and obligations. Meanwhile, here on the northern plains, winter and spring can never seem to decide who is actually in charge of April, and sometimes May too. One day, I'll be sweating in short sleeves, trying to turn a lamb that's in a breech presentation, and the next day, my husband will appear on the porch, his coat soaked through from sleet and snow, carrying a chilled down newborn calf in his arms. On a ranch, loss and worry is bundled into the joys of seasonal rebirth. For all the many successful births, there are also inevitably deaths. Lambs and calves born during foul weather in particular have a lower chance of survival. On the other hand, when the weather is warm and dry, as it has been this year, we fret over the lack of moisture and the threat of prairie fires. But this time of year, more than any other, I can easily see the distance between what I want and what I need, something that was much harder to observe during my suburban upbringing, and that has been a gift beyond measure. And what do I really need? I need to believe my labor has purpose. I need to see that the animals under my care are thriving and that our stewardship allows the other members of this ecosystem to thrive too. I need to be out in the hard wind and rain, my frozen fingers fumbling to milk a cow or bottle feed a baby lamb, so that when I return to the shelter of my house, I am flooded with gratitude for the warmth. I need to know there's a good neighbor a phone call away who will offer a piece of hardware to fix a broken water tank or a tube of ointment to treat an infected udder. In the summer, the new babies won't be so fragile anymore. The herd and flock will graze in the pastures, the chickens chase bugs across the yard. We will ride horses under the colored flag of evening just for pleasure. There will still be plenty of work to do, but we will have time to limn the expanse between what we want and what we need with the laughter of our children playing nearby, the animals healthy and thriving, and the stars that rise over our heads as the sun sets on another day.